but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Every year this time of year, I reach out to Dave Bartu. He is the college football matrix analytical. He is a guy who deals in data, and he does some things. It's kind of like the CIA. Like, you can't really explain what he does, but everybody kind of gets it after you talk to him. Bartu's joining us. How do you explain to people what you do as it pertains to colleges, coaching hires, data, and all that stuff?
I tell stories with numbers, right? You tell stories with your eyes. You watch a game. You talk to people. You get information, right? And you gather information, and you tell the story with your eyes and your ears, a lot of it through watching football. I tell stories about programs, whether it's staffing, advanced player identification, game performance, and so forth, with none of that. No X's, no O's, no videotape, just numbers and data. And the more data I have, the better I can tell a story. So when you and I are talking, or I'm talking to anybody, whether it's an athletic director or a head coach and a GM trying to build a staff, you know, in college football or the NFL, I'm telling a story with the numbers I see. And ultimately, I'm just trying to create efficiency, because data can cover a lot of area really, really quickly. And I'm trying to reduce acquisition risk. You know, don't hire a bad coach. Don't get a guy on the roster that can't even make it. And those are the things that we do across football.
Could you have warned Oregon State about Trent Bray, or is that something that is more feel when you see a guy interviewing?
No, that's a multi-pronged answer. Well, I got a good story about Trent Bray and becoming the DC at Oregon State, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go
right.
Ahead.
It's been
long
enough.
Let's do it.
Yeah, this is a fun story because the defensive coordinator before Trent at Oregon State, don't remember his name, but he's bad.
Tibisar,
right?
Tim Tibisar.
I just know he wasn't any
good. Yeah, he wasn't good.
And right, and for a couple of years. And then the year he got fired, I remember talking about him specific and the problems we were seeing inside the numbers, and that they were not progressing. They weren't getting better. And he was, and I really remember this, I remember talking about him before the season and mentioning that if he ever gets the chance, is our numbers say Trent Bray has really high potential as a defensive coordinator. Give him a shot, right? And I think it was game number 9 at Oregon State, they fired that defensive coordinator.
Yep.
And the defense was outside the top 100 in defensive scoring efficiency through 9 games. It was garbage, right? And the decision was made, let's give Trent a shot. And I laid out, here's how we are going to track his results over the next 3 games relative to what was done in the first 9. And Trent's 3 games were outstanding. And a lot of people wouldn't notice it because they'd looked at the whole year for Oregon State and get, oh, defensively, that wasn't very good. No, he ran a top 25 scoring efficiency defense in November. And that basically, it was like, okay, there's your guy. You don't even have to fill the position. You have him. And then you saw Trent go on and have wonderful defensive years with Smith and that staff before Smith went to Michigan State. And then he got hired as head coach. And I've gotten a lot from Beaver fans in terms of, well, I've seen it. I want another Kenny Dillingham. How is Kenny any different than Trent Bray? In fact, when you look at Kenny's profile on paper, it was actually worse than Trent. Trent had better years as a defensive coordinator. Both were alumni, right? Kenny of Arizona State, Trent at Oregon State, one offensively, one defensively. Kenny only had one good year as a play caller, and that was with Bo Nix at Oregon. Come on, right? You know, I mean, at Florida State, they were average. There was nothing that said Kenny was going to do what he did in year two at Arizona State. But see, now we're regressing, though, right? Because their offense is outside the top 100. Mm-hmm. Marcus Arroyo. Marcus Arroyo's only had three really good seasons, one with Justin Herbert, a bunch with Justin Herbert, one with Sam Levitt. Okay, that's why I think Sam Levitt's going to be awesome, because he made Arroyo look good. But you look at those two and you go, okay, what was really the difference? Well, on paper, both of them were about the same thing. But when Kenny got to Arizona State, what a lot of people don't realize is he has four coaches that he kept that were four-star plus coaches for their careers. Mm. Okay, he had four guys that were top 20 percentile in the country over the last 15 years. So he had a great, wonderful advantage in terms of staffing. And that's where Trent, and this is where most first-year head coaches struggle, okay? You had Bray, he brings in a staff. A lot of guys he knew, right? And are saying around here, you know, buddy hire is a fire hire. Mm. So, but a lot of these guys don't know much better, right? They're comfortable with their friends and guys that they can work around, but they don't know if they're really good or bad. And so there's a lot of risk there. So Oregon State, in hiring Trent, he went out and hired a very inexperienced, and some of the guys that he hired with experience just weren't good. This was a bottom 30 staff from day one. Okay. Trent Dilfer at UAB, bottom 30 staff from day one. He got fired too. If you look at a lot of the guys that got fired, they were bottom 30 staff from day one. They were right out the door having staffing problems. And if you look at the 12 FBS coaches that have been fired this year, nine of them had staffing issues in our grading system, right? I mean, you know, outside of James Franklin, who had a, you know, great offense and defensive coordinator, 34-8, and he gets fired. Crazy pills, right? You know, everybody else had staffing issues. And so this is the problem or the trouble with a guy that is right out of the gate. An athletic director doesn't know how to look at staffing, and they only think they're hiring the head coach. What we're trying to do is get athletic directors like a Barnes, right? If Barnes called me and said, okay, what am I looking at in a head coach? I would be like, well, one of the things we need to look at is who are the offense and defensive coordinator this guy's bringing in, right? Because he could be a great head coach like a Neil Brown, but Neil Brown had two terrible offensive defensive coordinator pairings, got him fired, even though his history was good. So we try to get athletic directors to also look at the entire staff, because they're paying for that, but it also is a really good indication of, is this going to sink or you know, float right out of the gate.
Dave Bartu is the College Football Matrix. You know, you're talking about coaching, and Oregon State's got a vacancy now. You said if you could talk to Scott Barnes, you'd talk about, hey, who are you going to get as the coordinators and whatnot. Would the Trent Bray experience make you shy away from hiring another candidate that hasn't been a head coach? Or is it more nuanced than that, that you're looking more at, like, even a Paul Christ, who's got the experience as a head coach? He's been out of the game for a year and last was a consultant at Texas. Like, who's he bringing in on his staff?
Exactly. Now, when it comes down to that was kind of two questions there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of it is like, who does Barnes hire? Okay. And one of our philosophies when we work with an AD, a lot of fans will go, oh, well, an AD can hire whoever they want. No, they can't. Right. And we call it the pile of chips they have in front of them. Right. How many chips do you have in front of you? Right. So like Jeremy Foley, a lot of fans listening right now, you don't know who that is. That was a long time AD at the University of Florida. He won national championships and everything. His pile of chips was as big as it gets. Right. I mean, you're talking about a guy, you know, like Geno Smith at Ohio State. He could hire his grandma that goes 0-48 and fire her and he'd still keep his job. Right? A new AD, brand new AD, little tiny chip pile. You can't take a risky hire. So when I look at a Barnes at Oregon State, the first thing I would ask is, how big is his chip pile right now? Well, with Bray, he had a pretty good pile of chips when Jonathan left. Those chips have been cashed in quite a bit, right? So you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say his chip pile has dwindled to the point where, can you do the same thing that you just did and still keep your job if it doesn't work, right? And so you would probably answer that question better than me. But in my experience, it's not going to be a guy that has absolutely no experience unless the balloons have been floated where, you know, let's say you bring a Will Stein from Oregon, who's had a lot of success, not just at Oregon. He turned around the UTSA offense instantly as well. And if you've got a lot of fans that are behind it relative to your chip pile, that might be a good hire. So I'm not saying they wouldn't hire a guy that has no experience like Trent. I'm just sure it's not going to be a guy that is defensive that has no experience. I could see a Will Stein, but something tells me with that chip pile, it's going to be somebody more of a veteran stabilizing presence, even if it's for just 3, 4, 5 years.
Dave Bartu is with us. One thing that has come up is, you know, you've got roster building in college football that is mirroring a little bit of the NFL, you know, with they've got a budget. They have to determine how to allocate their money. Oregon State this last year gave $1.5 million to a quarterback who's standing on the sideline holding a clipboard. That is not a good investment. It has a $50,000 guy, you know, on the field in his place. Do you do any of that work? Is your phone ringing in that way where our GMs and programs asking you to kind of look at the roster and go, hey, how much money should we be allocating on a left tackle if this is our budget? What percentage of our budget goes to each player? Is it that simple or is it case by case?
No, it's not that simple because that information isn't out there. It's not like the NFL where all the contracts are disclosed, right? You have no idea what guys are getting paid. And to unbalance, right? Recruiting is all about unbalance, right? If Oregon State offers John Canzano $100,000 and Boise State offers you $100,000, Washington offers you $100,000, but the Washington booster meets your dad at the casino and slides him $50,000 in chips like we used to do it.
Yeah.
No, it's still unbalanced, right? Everybody's like, well, everybody's getting paid, so it's equal. No, the goal of business is to make it unequal. It is to unlevel the playing field. So sure, they're getting paid, but they're still getting the bag on the other side too. So, but to answer your question about how do you allocate this stuff, our goal in player evaluation, we look at foundational athleticism. Do you have the athleticism to make the roster or not? And our goal is to help our programs, whether they're getting guys in the transfer portal or advanced player identification, we're trying to avoid the risk of a guy that can't make the roster, right? Or of paying for a guy who just simply doesn't have the athleticism to get there. And so I think that's really our part of it. But back to your question about how do you pay these guys, you really don't have any idea, because there's no central clearinghouse for these contracts. So we're not at the point yet where a GM can go, okay, I know what everybody's getting paid and what I have and what I can afford. That's just not there yet. It's still, you know, throwing darts in the dark.
Yeah, Jed Fish at Washington had talked about, you know, well, we have a formula. Can you, if you have the data internally, come up with a formula? Or is this just coaches sitting around going, well, we know that a cover corner and a defensive tackle and, you know, a big left tackle and a quarterback are our biggest desires, and so we're going to allocate that. But if you had the data internally, could you come up with a formula?
You could, and a lot of it would depend on the offense and defense you want to run, right? A lot of it would depend on, let's say, a Jed Fish in terms of how he wants to build a roster. You know, does he build it from the inside out? Do we prioritize defensive line, offensive line? You know, or are we okay fudging on that, having smaller guys as long as we have elite speed or as much speed as we can on the outside? So anybody can develop a formula in terms of what they want. That's one of the things that we can do with the data, right? You know, I mean, if you said, okay, Dave, build a winning roster in the mold of Boise State. Okay, cool. I can go look at all of Boise State's roster and break down how many guys are at each position in terms of depth. If we had better injury information, we can forecast, okay, you are going to have this many guys hurt at these positions. Here is where the minimum number of guys we need at each position. So all of these buckets can be balanced if the data is there to parse through and be able to create that formula.
You know, we always look at some programs like Utah football comes to mind. A couple of years ago, they had this cluster of injuries and everybody said, well, it has to be their training. Have you had programs bring you in and say, look at our injuries. Are we doing something wrong here? Or is it just this is what happens?
It's ironic you're talking about injury bugs and voodoo stuff like that living in the Rose City with Trailblazers.
Hey now. Yeah. Is it the water? Is it the air? What's going on with big guys in the Blazers?
I think that's just selection bias. It's bad luck, right? I mean, it's all the same floor. I don't think, you know, from a training standpoint, I don't think you can point to one thing. I can tell you, I did a really in-depth analysis. There was a head coach in the Big Ten that wanted his turf go from AstroTurf to grass, and really wanted to dive deeper than we could go on the effects. And so what we actually did is we teamed up with their engineering department, and they were testing the grass and the turf. And for the most part, in terms of rebound and how hard it was, and it was really, really equal. But where it was different was a pivot event. Okay, that grass catching a cleat and that pivot motion, right? If you're standing on the floor and you pivot 180 degrees, if you're on a hardwood floor, it slides, right? There's nothing to catch it. There's no friction there. If you're on carpet, there's friction. Grass has a lot less friction than that turf. And some turf is interweaved, and it creates even more friction and more injuries. So the conclusion was, it depends on the turf. If you're going to have AstroTurf, it needs to be one that isn't woven with a lot of friction involved with it. But ultimately, the grass is fundamentally better. You look at Europe soccer, turf is outlawed. It's all grass. So there's a little bit there in terms of the injuries. But, you know, sometimes you just get bit by the bug and sometimes you don't.
Dave Bartu is the College Football Matrix. He's agreed to stick around for another segment. Coming back, Dave, I want to ask you a little bit about Lincoln Riley, Dan Lanning's performance relative to his talent, what's going on with Mario Cristobal, plus the eye test and strength of schedule as it pertains to college football playoff rankings. Is that myth or is it fact? We'll talk about it with Dave Bartu coming back.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750, The Game.
Dave Bartu is the College Football Matrix. It's been a fantastic conversation. We're continuing it here. Look, let's start Lincoln Riley, USC, Oregon. This is the biggest game in history, the biggest game on the planet coming up this weekend. How is Lincoln Riley doing? How do you think he is doing relative to what the data says he should be doing?
Oh, well, Lincoln's doing okay. I think Lincoln's doing okay. I mean, we're seeing some progression offensively. It's there. Right, we're talking top three scoring efficiency in the country, so that really hasn't changed. Defensively, year to date, right now, I think they're sitting about 47th. Not great, you know, certainly not elite, but much better than what we're used to under a Lincoln Riley coach defense. So, you know, I just wonder if he's going to stay. You know, I'm curious about it. I know there was a little bit of smoke about that. And knowing some of the family members inside that staff, you know, there's more than smoke there. It's a possibility. I think that he could move on and head back towards Oklahoma, Louisiana, the central part of the country. But right now, oh my God, this game is awesome. This game is awesome. And here's the thing, though, is I think this is for a playoff spot, man.
Yeah.
I really think, and I know Duck fans do not want to hear this, okay? And we can get into the playoff committee metrics later because I've worked with dozens of ADs that have been on the committee. We have the models. I know how these guys behave. I mean, you saw me post it last night. I mean, our projection got 1 through 11 dead on before they even came out. These guys do the same thing every time. You look at Oregon, they have wonderful game control, but they don't have the top 25 wins. Right. They can't lose this game. They'll be at the bottom of the 10-2 teams. And there's too many in the SEC. There's too many 10-2 teams. So I think the loser of this game at Autzen goes home. I don't think it will be Oregon, but I think the pressure on this game is going to be a lot more than people are giving it credit for, because both of these teams, because if USC beats Oregon, they're winning out, right? I mean, they're finishing with two losses. They're going to the playoffs instead of Oregon and vice versa. And I've been to a lot of Duck games. I was a season ticket holder for 17 years, and I have not been as excited to go to a football game in Audson in a long time. I think there is so much riding on this game.
Yeah, you talk about the lack of a top 25 win. I know strength of schedule is kind of a weak metric, but how does that play out? Like, what do you see the committee doing as far as strength of schedule is concerned? Do you agree with their take on it, or is it just kind of that's what they have to, you know, use, and this is a tool, one of the tools that they're having there available in their toolbox?
Oh, I like the tool. I like the tool. It cracks me up that people still listen to the committee chair talk after the ranking. I mean, it's a word salad. That's all it is, right? I mean, you know, it has to be that way because it has to keep the fans on the toes. The fans want to believe it's complex, and they're watching football games, and there's no eye test, right? Strength of schedule, fans want to go, oh, it's so important. Look, we talked to Bill Hancock the first week that the playoffs were announced. We got all the basic formulas. We know what is important and what is overlooked. Strength of schedule, and you've heard me say it a million times, and I'll say it again for the people in the back, there is no correlation between the quality of a team and the strength of their schedule. None. Zero. Zip. Zilch. Okay? And how strength of schedule is applied by the committee, I like it because they use it last. Okay, it's the last thing they use. So if it comes down to the 10th spot, because folks, don't look at the top 12. Top 12 doesn't get you into the playoffs because number 11 is going to be the ACC champ and number 12 is going to be the G6. Okay, it's top 10. You're outside the top 10, you're busted. That's it. So when you look at all these these two lost teams, if Oregon goes to, let's say, finishes at 10-2, they'll go to strength of schedule if everything is equal. Okay, Oregon has wonderful game control, the most important number in the committee. But they don't have the quality wins. They don't have the top 25 wins. If the committee goes, okay, these two teams at 10-2, Oregon and, you know, whatever, Ole Miss. Okay, who has the better strength of schedule? That's the tiebreaker. It's like everything is equal. Who had the toughest schedule? That's how they use it. In the very, very end, when they break up teams, you will actually see, like in their final rankings, when you see a bunch of teams that are equal, all you have to do is go across our spreadsheet to strength of schedule, and it's almost verbatim in order. Even right now, Ohio State, best strength of schedule. Indiana, number two. Texas A&M, number three. In that order, right? Game control. Ohio State, number one. Indiana, number two. Texas A&M, number three. In that order.
Help me with this. Help me with this metric, game control, because there's people listening who don't know that.
Exactly. And it's a little bit of a funky one. I can't tell you that we know exactly to the decimal point what game control is in the current formula. But the essence of it is a modified margin of victory. People were mad when the playoff committee chair would come out and talk margin of victory in the first couple of years. So they said, okay, we won't talk about it anymore. We're going to call it something else. We're going to call it game control. Right? We're going to wordsmith it and make it flowery. And really what it is how bad did you beat somebody else's ass? That's it. That's really what it is. But how well did you control the game? First quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. And then it's weighted, right? If you're up 10 in the first quarter, you have X amount of game control, but that is weighted less than being up two scores in the second quarter, weighted less than being up three scores in the third, up four scores in the fourth. And they have a cap on it. The playoff committee does have a margin of victory cap at 21 points. You can't go any higher than that. That's considered a blowout level for them. But for everybody listening, game control is a critical number. And then you work it backward. Okay, Oregon has wonderful game control, but they haven't beat nobody, right? They got no top 25 wins right now. And for folks saying, oh, they beat Iowa when they were top 25. Nope. A top 25 win by the playoff committee were they in the top 25 last week? Iowa was not in the top 25 last week. Therefore, ergo, no top 25 wins. Okay. If Iowa happens to pop back in there, top 25 win. So Oregon needs to beat USC, but not, well, actually, if Oregon wins out, they're in. But, you know, Iowa winning out, having those top 25 wins at the end, are a really, really big deal. And that's why you get this fluidity in November, because quality wins and top 25 wins come and go each and every week.
The SEC honks on ESPN are going to, they've already started creating the case for a three-loss SEC team possibly sneaking into the playoff. Texas is the team I think about. If Texas beats Texas A&M, Texas has bad losses, but they're going to make the case. They're going to do it.
You're as bad as ESPN people. You are killing
brain
cells.
I know, but tell me why the committee wouldn't. I fear, that's my fear. Texas is sitting. Tell me.
It doesn't fit. Texas can't get into the top 10 with three losses. They're not getting into the top 10. It's just there's just no way for them to fit it in there. Ole Miss is not losing. Okay, Georgia and Alabama probably not losing another game. Those guys are going to be in the championship games. Oklahoma, they got nothing left, right? A&M's in. It doesn't matter if Texas blows out A&M. There's only room for 10 teams.
Yeah.
Right. There's going to be five from the SEC. There's going to be three from the Big Ten. There's going to be one champion from the Big 12. There's going to be the ACC champion, and there's going to be the group of six best team, whatever the heck you want to call it. So what is that? 8, 9, 10, 11. So you got room for one more. Maybe Utah and Texas Tech if they're in the Big 12 championship game.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Okay.
Right? ACC gets one.
Let me ask you about the Big 12, because Texas Tech is their best team, but is the best case for the Big 12 for someone else to win the Big 12 championship game and get into the playoff, like Utah gets in or BYU gets in? And because Texas Tech, you would think, finishes, 10th, maybe.
But dude, you are dancing with the devil. Again, you have a 10-2 team with a poor strength of record and a poor strength of schedule. Yes, they have the game control, but the strength of record and strength of schedule really knocks that down. But there's so many 10-2 teams that have played tougher schedules and tougher competition that it's you're just walking on such thin ice right now. I think it's really, really difficult. But, that being said, I think for the Big 12 to get two teams in, having a Utah beat a Texas Tech, it would be optimal. BYU beat a Texas Tech, I think that would be optimal as well. We still got a couple weeks left, so there's going to be, there's got to be a little bit. Oh, Notre Dame, right? They're in. So I forgot. That's what I was looking
that's
for.
Right.
What was that?
12? Yeah, that's the extra team. Right. Yep.
So the Texas is not going over five SEC 2-10 teams. No, not going to happen.
I hope not. Dave Bartu is the college football matrix. Herbie and those guys are already starting to talk about, Texas, look at their, despite the fact they lost to Florida, despite the fact that they got blown off the field against Georgia. Oh, look at Texas. They could still beat Texas A&M. And wouldn't that prove they belong to be in there? Like, no, that's not how it works, or it shouldn't work. Bartu, let me ask you about Mario Cristobal before we go here. Great recruiting classes. Mm-hmm. Right now, it looks like he's on the outside looking in. But what do you make of what Miami has done there? And what would you advise Cristobal to do moving forward?
Win closer games. I think that's really what it comes down to, because he's the best individual recruiter in college football. And I know everybody wants to go Dan Lanning, Dave, right in your backyard. Dan's got pretty big blank check with Phil, a little bit bigger than Mario. So Dan's great, but I still say, and I'm biased. I work with Mario a lot more than Dan, so I'm a little bit biased there. But recruiting-wise, Miami's solid. They recruit from the inside out, and that has paid great benefits for them. But I think the biggest change is when you look at the numbers, what he did at Oregon versus what he is doing at Miami. Because at Oregon, he was able to win the close games. Okay. At Oregon, when he was leading at halftime, he was by 9 or more, he was 16-2. Right at the FBS average. Okay. When he was leading by one score at halftime, he was 7-2, 78%. Conference average, 70%. He was above conference average. When the game was tied at halftime, he was 4-0 as a Duck. Okay, 100%. Average in the FBS, 50%. When he was trailing at Oregon, he was 5-1 at halftime. Okay, and you go down through the numbers into the third quarter. Plus, I mean, when the game was tied, he was 23% above FBS average. You get into the fourth quarter with 7.5 minutes remaining. Tied games. He was 2-0. When he was trailing, he was 2-3, but that's 40%. That is the FCS average is 13. So at Oregon, his numbers in tight games were well above average across the board. But then you go over to Miami, a little bit different talent profile, but still extremely good. This is where it really falls apart. You look at halftime when he's leading by one score, he's 8-5. Okay. At Oregon, he was 7-2. Right? There's a three-game swing right there. When he was tied, he was only 50-50. When he was trailing, he was at 33%, not 40. So you look at overall, those numbers are closer to FBS averages. And so when I break it down, somewhere there is a disconnect. Recruiting's there. We got a good defensive coordinator in Heatherman. Love bringing that guy in from Miami, from Minnesota. That's worked. Got a decent offensive coordinator. That's worked. Just somewhere in there, the game management, and maybe it's a mental expectation. Mm-hmm. It dropped a full game. That's it. See, because last year they win one more game, they're in. This year they win one more game, they're in. There is just something in there that isn't connecting at Miami in terms of winning those tight games the way it did at Oregon.
He needs you in the headset in the box. That's what he needs, right?
It's not like that. Yeah. It's not like that. It's just the game management. And I haven't really pinned it down because we just started working on game management quality index because a couple of athletic directors in the SEC asked me to. And you want to talk about numbers that'll blow your mind. We can cover that one day.
Dave Bartu, you're the best. I appreciate you joining us. Grab a podcast of this show wherever you get a podcast. And remember, we're back tomorrow with another great show. Dave Bartu, thank you. Thanks to Steven. The Bald-Faced Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time.